Joining us are two regular political observers. They are, of course, E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution, and David Brooks of the New York Times. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much.
As we've just heard, Iraq once again is on the front burner here in Washington. David, I want to begin with you. Is this good news for the president, we assume?
Oh, yeah. Actually, there's been a little turnaround. I'd say the mood has gone from despair to, well, let's see. And I think, obviously, the killing of Zarqawi is a part of that. Obviously, the intelligence trove they've apparently found after that as a part of that. But I think the other thing that's happened is within the Bush administration, there's been a much wider debate about how to proceed. And to me, one of the most important and little reported things that's happened was that the president and Secretary Rumsfeld and others had four outside experts come in, including Frederick Kagan and Elliot Cohen and Mike Vickers. And they came in to really have a full board debate about how to proceed militarily in Iraq. And that's something they've had internally, but there have been a lot of views that have been shut out. And Kagan, for example, is somebody who believes in the short term we have to insert 22,000 more troops, get it done right away, and then see if we can succeed.
Was that in itself extraordinary that this White House in particular had said, you know, we're going to sit people down, we're going to look outside for counsel?
Yeah, and I think it was, I wouldn't say extraordinary, but unusual, because this is an administration that has not exactly been intimate with its critics. And these are people who were all extremely critical of the way the war is being conducted, and especially critical of the way Donald Rumsfeld has been conducting the war. And I'd say there has been a shift within the administration, especially since Josh Bolton took over as chief of staff. Much more openness. We've seen that in Tony Snow, the spokesman who's a little more open than the old guy, but also in the way they're talking to people around Washington and to people with Capitol Hill. You know, it's a small speck of that was that Denny Hastert, the Speaker of the House, got to ride on Air Force One, something that hasn't happened. And finally, they're communicating with their friends and allies and also now with their critics. So I think that's been a very positive development.
And speaking of Air Force One, with the president's popcorn visit to Iraq this week and taken together with the killing of Zarqawi, you see a shift in the polls also. Is this did the president get a lift here? Is this a sea change?
I don't think it's a sea change. I think you can tell how much trouble the president is in by the size of the headlines this week. Bush has good week. And the fact that that was big news suggests where he's been up to now. And I think that when you stay at 30-something percent in the polls for as long as the president has, it gets harder and harder to dig out. On Iraq, I think what remains the case is that Americans at this point are not going to be hugely influenced even by successful, you know, media events, and perhaps it was more than that, we'll find out, like the president's trip to Iraq. I think people, Americans on this, are very pragmatic. They're going to say, okay, did this visit mean anything? 1 month, 2 months from now, is Iraq safe or has the level of violence reduced? And so I think the test is not in the atmospherics, and they've had a good week in atmospherics, but what happens in Iraq? The other thing is you don't have to be a shrewd Republican spinmeister to say that an unindicted Karl Rove is better for the president than an indicted Karl Rove is.
I'd like to play a clip from the president's news conference in the Rose Garden yesterday. Listen to how he frames the war in Iraq.
If the United States of America leaves before this Iraqi government can defend itself and sustain itself and govern itself, it'll be a major blow in the war on terror. Al-Qaeda will benefit. And make no mistake about it, they still want to do innocent people harm, whether it be in the Middle East or whether it be here in the United States of America. The stakes are high in Iraq.
Stakes are high in Iraq. David, are we beginning to hear the 2008 campaign rhetoric, the message there in that statement?
Well, I think it's indisputably true that if, however, whatever one thinks of how we went into the war, if we're chased out of the war by al-Qaeda in Iraq and by others, it will certainly be a victory for al-Qaeda. So I think that is the stakes. And in the Republican side, the mood is one of unenthusiasm or pessimism. On the Democratic side, it's a real split. It's a real difference of principle about whether to stay or not. With Clinton, Mark Warner, some of the others saying we've got to stick it out, basically for the reasons the president outlined, and others, John Kerry, Nancy Pelosi this week, saying, no, we've got to get out of there, and most prominently, of course, John Murtha. That's actually where the debate is most interesting on the Democratic side.
On the Republican side, though, risky strategy to bet the House on Iraq, the House and the Senate?
Well, that's the truth. I mean, the fundamental fact is the president has bet his presidency on Iraq. He's bet his party's future on Iraq. In some large respects, he's bet his country's foreign policy credibility on Iraq. So that's just facing reality.
EJ, have the Democrats found their voice on this issue?
Well, I think you've got a paradox here. The paradox is that the Bush approach to Iraq has created so many problems that there really is no good solution right now. Therefore, when you ask a Democrat, what do you believe? The Democrats are split. I think the Republicans are actually more split than they look. The Republicans have the advantage of controlling the White House. And for now, they're saying we're ready to go with what President Bush wants to do. But because there is no obvious solution, there is no obvious thing for an opposition party to say.
And an opposition party that's hamstrung because it's hard to criticize a war that many of them authorized.
That's correct. And Kerry, in his speech this week, went out of his way to say, I made a mistake in voting for the war. Hillary Rodham Clinton doesn't want to say that, is not prepared to say that. But the funny thing is, it's not because this policy is successful that the Democrats have this problem. It's because the policy has created so many problems that the Democrats have this problem. And I think David's right that the Republicans have bet the house on Iraq and the country's security future on Iraq, so they have to come up with some way of talking about it. And what they've decided is they wanted a choice between cut and run, as they want to characterize the position of half of the Democratic Party, and staying the course. The Democrats are desperately trying to change the argument into one, how can you stay a course that's not working? But for now, I think the Republicans have found a crisp, if manipulative, rhetorical construction that they think is going to work in the fall.
And who speaks for the Democrats? Is there a central voice in the sense that we are a nation at war and the commander-in-chief speaks essentially for the GOP? Who is the central voice for the Democrats?
There is none, and there was none when the Republicans were in opposition. A congressional party simply cannot speak with one voice. The closest anybody came to that was Newt Gingrich for a brief period when he seemed to speak for the Republican Party from the speakership, but that was very unusual and it eventually went away. So there is no one Democrat who can speak for the party until a Democrat is nominated for president in 2008. And so the Democrats simply have to get used to that and figure out how to deal with it.
We have to stop there. Good to talk to both of you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
E.J. Dionne is a columnist for The Washington Post and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and David Brooks is a columnist for The New York Times.